I, James, am neither a god nor an angel, but a man like any other. Therefore, I act like a man and confess to loving those dear to me more than other men. You may be sure that I love the Earl of Buckingham more than anyone else, and more than you who are here assembled. I wish to speak on my own behalf, and not to have it thought to be a defect, for Jesus Christ did the same, and therefore I cannot be blamed. Jesus had his John, and I have my George. Welcome back, my little hormones. If you haven't guessed already, today we're talking about King James I of England and VI of Scotland, one of Britain's many queenly kings, who's best known for uniting the Scottish and English crowns, or attempting to, translating the Bible into English, and shtupping the hottest twinks in town along the way. Now, for the last 200 years, scholars have avoided the topic of James's sexuality because it was simply a little too, what's the word, faggy? literally, one bio of his that I read was like, let's focus on the politics, guys, okay? Everyone has gay thoughts sometimes. But in more recent years, it's become commonplace to acknowledge the sexual nature of James's relationships with his favorites. And yes, I am using air quotes because some say favorites, I say kept boys. These favorites, or minions, as they were sometimes referred to, accompanied James everywhere, slept in bed with him, received land, jewelry, titles, rich wives from him, kissed and caressed him in public, and, in George Villiers' case, even acquired totally platonic pet names in private letters, such as wife, or more hole-gapingly, son. But yes, they were probably all just very close wife friends. The questions are, how did the bumbling, lanky teenage king of Scotland become the much-loved and later much-reviled queen of queens at the turn of the 17th century? Who were his favorites? And most importantly, who was George Villiers, the wiliest and cum-faciest of them all? How many of the sex scenes in the new Star show Mary and George should we read as primary sources? And in this tale of so many fairies, who was the fairest girl with a pearl necklace of them all? It's time to dive in. So put on your silk stockings and literally nothing else. Because the water is what, guy?
Human temperature.
So let's go back in time and take another rewrite through our history. Celebrate ourselves tonight and cover all the things that still a mystery.
Welcome back, everyone. I am so thrilled about this week's guest. I can't believe that he has even deigned to join us. Put your ears together for Guy Branum, actor, comedian, and writer. Guy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Bash. It's good to be here. I love this podcast, and I love everything it's doing. And I love the favorites of our British monarchs.
First of all, I'm gonna do a little credit roll for you because okay. I want everyone to know what a big deal you are. Okay. First and foremost, you will have seen Guy in the recent rom-com Bros, playing the absolutely scene-stealing best friend Henry. Also, LOL at that movie because Billy Eichner's character literally does a podcast about queer history.
Yep.
And I have never identified with anyone more. I like to think that it's based on me, but yes. Who knows?
You came to the premiere and you did a really good job of just like making friends. You just were building allies at every moment.
Thank you. Thank you. Vodka will do that to you. That was such a fun New York night, that premiere. So thank you for bringing me to that. Also, just as importantly, you were recently on the Apple TV series Platonic with Rose Byrne, and Seth Rogen, which I fucking loved. So
Thanks.
Funny, so genuine and real. And like, I just adored the writing in it. You're a TV writer. I think I saw you first actually on Chelsea Lately back
yes.
in the day when I was, just a small gay twinkle in my father's eye.
That is a thing that I did.
And you've written a memoir, you have a comedy album. I mean, she's done it all, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes,
so
it's
so
called
seriously.
A career.
Wow, maybe I should get one. Well, I envy, I admire your career deeply. I also admire that you are one of the, I think you're one of the smartest stand-ups that I've ever had the pleasure of seeing and knowing. And specifically of relevance to this podcast, you're actually quite a history buff.
And I
want
to say you are one of the smartest comedians' cousins whom I have ever experienced.
Right. That is actually, that's crucial context. That Guy and I first met at my cousin Kara Klink's wedding.
And the efficiency with which she was just like, you're going to like my cousin Sebastian. Like, that's what you should do this weekend is just chit chat with him. And then I did. And I danced with your aunts.
True. Yes. We actually met in a dance off on the dance floor, I'm pretty sure. Uh-huh. That was kind of the first coming together.
Yes.
But tell me a little bit about your love of history. I'm always curious how people get into this business.
I maintain that Tolkien only wrote the Lord of the Rings as a gateway drug so that you would eventually find yourself 15 years later reading very long, dry books about Prussian history.
Genius.
I think I lived on a little farm town and there was nothing to do. I lived in the middle of an almond orchard, so I did a lot of time reading the encyclopedia, and then you start realizing that there's juicy stuff. And then as time goes on, as this podcast particularly plumbs, you start to realize that so many things that you thought were not in the historical record are there. There are gays and women who are doing amazing things. And, far more people of color, in Europe, in the historical record, making splashes, that, history is a whole lot less straight and male and white than you think it is. And if you look hard enough, you find those stories.
How did you come to queer people in history? Who was your first?
I mean, it's literally going to sound like the dumbest, it really is going to sound like the dumbest, but Forster?
That's not the dumbest. The dumbest would be Oscar Wilde.
Yes, that is very
fair.
That
would be lame.
That is very fair, but there was this run of really great Merchant Ivory films of adaptations of Forster novels, and
yes.
I loved and enjoyed them and didn't, there's that coming to realization that these things that I love because they are queer. It's just when none of us experienced The Little Mermaid for the first time, were they a faggot has written instructional songs about how we should understand the world. But, yet they are,
Yeah.
And I think that realizing, coming to realize that Wolf, the Bloomsbury group was so gay, and realizing that Wolf and Forster and Keynes and Lytton Strachey and all of these people were leading complex queer lives, I think was really a thing. And then also I think I was a British history major, and just getting to the point where your professor is sort of and James had favorites. And, it was, I went to Berkeley, so there was, more sort of expounding upon the reality of the queer identity of these people. We're talking about one favorite today, but the first Duchess of Marlborough was a person who, mm-hmm. When I found out that there was this lady who managed to leverage Queen Anne's attention on her into running politics in the country for half a decade, I was just where's that story? And then Yorgos Lanthimos made a good movie about it.
Rachel Weisz, perfect.
The best.
Just a quick note from your editor. If you're looking for more hot goss on royal favorites, check out season 2, episode 6 of this podcast, where Lucy and Bash watch The Favorite.
You also have to do a lot of reading and learning before you come to the point that you are able to start adding your own speculation and deep readings into the game.
So you know about British history. I knew that you were going to know about things already. It's not like I'm going to be explaining things to you. But what do you know about James I or any of the gay kings of England? I feel like we talked about this once.
Well, it's a lot of seconds. I was very surprised to find out that I had not realized that William Rufus, who was kind of like a dude bro hunting masculine king, was super gay. Also nicknamed Kurt Hose. And there's nothing worse than being a gay king whose nickname is your dick isn't that long.
Wait, what was it? It was what? Kurt Hose?
Kurt Hose. Like, which might have meant he wore short socks.
Oh, like court, like cool.
Yeah.
Short.
And it might have meant that his dick was short. And then, you know, we've got Edward II. And, you know, I saw that movie with Tilda Swinton when I was younger. And then
it's kind of boring.
It is. And then, you know, James was the little baby of Mary Queen of Scots, who became King of Scotland when he was very young. And then he sort of really was probably the first of the gay kings who I learned about in like a college class. Because he, like, in addition to having favorites, he's got these affectations. Like, he's the guy who, and also, like, he's got a queerness that is so wrapped up in Christianity and Protestant Christianity. And I think one of the things I think is most interesting about this story, and I'm really interested to hear you lay it out, is just thinking about the way that a church that is not 50 years old, like Henry says that they are Protestant whenever, but it's not until like Elizabeth lays down the 95 theses or whatever.
Oops, another editor's note. Guy meant to say 39 articles. Silly guy.
That, like, this becomes a church. And, like, what does it mean to this man to be the head of a church and also be gay and also love God, you know? Like, that is interesting to me. And I just wonder how much the fact that this was a church that was building new rules gave him space to understand his queer desire within it.
Yeah, no, that's such an interesting point, because he definitely was a thinker. He loved theology. He wrote a lot, actually. He wrote about monarchy. He wrote about witches, because of course.
Yes.
He wrote about the craft. He wrote about, he was obviously playing around with a lot of big ideas all the time in his head. So I think that's a good point, because Protestantism, I think the appeal of it was that it was like the literate Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. You don't accept what you're told automatically.
Well, it's also democratized. It is like, you are not told what you should believe. Everyone gets a vernacular copy of the Bible and the opportunity.
Thanks to James.
Yeah.
And interesting. It is. It's probably the only translation that I would be interested in reading. But besides being a gay youth pastor, we're going to get to a lot of the other stuff that you mentioned around James, Mary Queen of Scots, etc. Before we get into it, though, I must know what you are thinking about the Mary and George show that is coming out with Mother Julianne Moore and that Twinkie guy. Nicholas Galitzine.
Galitzine. Well, his last name is an important reminder that he is descended from Russian nobility in some way. And
was wondering that.
That's delicious in and of itself. The fact that Julianne Moore is in it makes me trust it. Like, she has good taste. This is, you know, a lady who shows back up and does whatever our greater world of Todds tell her to do. You know, she makes good choices. The fact that it's on Stars, I have questions about. But I'm also like, there are so many Stars historical series that I probably would have found hot. I'm excited for it. But also a little bit, I'm like, I feel like it is like just working off of the residual energy of The Favourite, and I didn't love, Catherine the Great, or The Great. Because it wasn't
really.
Once I realized it wasn't going to be historically accurate, I was just like, I'm walking away. But like, I loved The Favourite so much. I felt like The Favourite got what was terrible and great about Anne so well, and what was terrible and great about Sarah Churchill so well. I do not care about Abigail Masham.
Nobody did.
Yeah.
Except Anne.
Yeah.
Except Anne. I thought Emma Stone was great playing her.
No,
she made her much more interesting than she probably was.
She was really great. And it's a film with a really problematized protagonist, which I love. And in the end, I guess Abigail is the protagonist. But yeah. Like, to me, the other two ladies are way more interesting.
The stars of it all is worrying me. I don't understand why Julianne Moore.
My art has been commended as being strongly vaginal, which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable. Vagina.
Academy Award winner is on the network Stars. That's the only thing that I'm sort of like, there's a disconnect here.
I'll bet you she attached at the pitching stage, and then Stars was the person who bought it from them. And Stars probably gave them what they wanted and needed to be able to make that show well. But also, that kid wasn't famous yet. It is always weird to understand how much people understand when these actors are about to pop, whether they are going to pop and move the needle or whatever. But sometimes a weird place buys your good idea, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And you know, like, Stars has done historic period pieces that I loved. I don't know if you ever saw The White Queen about Elizabeth of York. It's preposterous. It's I think a Philippa Gregory or whatever that woman is who wrote the other Boleyn girl and those ones. But she's a witch. They're just full blown witches.
Oh, I mean, I like
infiltrating
that.
Infiltrating the court. It's awesome. It's so good. It's very titty, very courtly, very witchy.
Yeah.
It rocks. So no, I like what Stars is doing. I just want to make sure that it's the right vehicle for our dearly beloved.
I also like that they did not make James hot. Like, I think it could have been very easy to make James hot. And, like, I like that Nicholas, what's his name, gets to look like a hot person of now. And James has to have that dumb hair and facial hair.
I know. I was watching it and I was like, I love all of their, like, lesbian, like, short on the sides, long on top haircuts. Like, all of the little twinks.
Act One, a short history of Christian sodomy.
Okay, let's get into it. So I like to start with a little bit of context for the listeners, especially when we're talking about the Christianity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And we did an episode on Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare, where I talked about this a little bit. But I think it's super interesting how there is quite a lot of queerness in the church and in Christian Europe.
The Catholic Church has never said no one can be gay. It has only ever said only we can be gay. And that's high level mean girlsing, and I respect that.
Exactly. Very, 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 you cannot sit with us.
Yes.
And specifically the idea of, you know, everyone thinks of like sodomy as that kind of the buzzword of Christian homophobia. But there were actually a lot of debates in the Middle Ages about whether sodomy was natural or not, because obviously it was a part of God's world. Mm-hmm. So did that mean that it was a part of his plan and therefore, you know, fair game for us mere mortals? It's only actually in the Renaissance that people start to get super uptight about this stuff, which is also when all of the Italian painters start getting their faggiest.
That's bonkers. That's when they're getting weird about it. Gay sex in the Middle Ages seems like it would be really like dirty and rough. I'm questioning how clean one could get oneself, and I'm wondering what lubes we have to work with north of like the olive production line.
This is not ancient Greece.
Right. And where, like, the Renaissance, I feel like we have all of these great new Arabic irrigation techniques that are giving us, like, pressurized water that we could use for various purposes.
They preserved all of that knowledge for us.
Yes.
No, that's a question I want to return to at the end, because it's something I think about. That is my Roman Empire. How did people douche?
Yes.
How did people douche for all of human history? Because you know that they were we know that they were fucking. Well, like, that's not in question.
Yes, but I have questions about the Greek fucking between the fact that the word means between the thighs or whatever. And I do sometimes wonder whether, like, I don't know, that hole is, like, really easy, though. You know, it is a hole.
Wait, the thigh hole or the actual hole?
No, I'm saying the actual hole. I was sort of like, were they just fucking each other between the thighs? I mean, that's good pressure. But yeah, I have to imagine people are fucking in the real hole.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to it because I have some theories on that. But the reason that it becomes such a big deal in the Renaissance is because of the Black Death. Mm-hmm. So everyone's dying, right? Everyone's got the plague. Everyone thinks that God is punishing them. And sodomy becomes, you know, part of a host of reasons that people use to explain all of this shit show surrounding them. And that's actually something that continues into the English Renaissance, the French Renaissance. Sodomy is sort of seen as a disruptive force to the natural order. So sodomy is also crucially not just defined as like today sodomy means butt fucking, right? But sodomy was a much bigger concept back then. So first, sexually, it refers to anything that isn't baby creating missionary sex between a man and a woman. Right. So you got your blowjobs, you got your bestiality, you've got all of these different things that are rallied under that umbrella of sodomy. But then some scholars also think that sodomy is sort of a catch-all term for anything that's sort of excessive or debauched.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a byword for depravity overall. It's mm-hmm. It's not just doing it in the butt is the point. Even though it gets used in that context quite a lot, right? Like men who are queer or being accused of being queer are called sodomites. We know that. But I think this is an important thing to keep in mind when we get to the fact that later King James is railing against sodomy in one of his works in the Basilicon Doron, where he's writing about kingship. And scholars use that to say, oh, but obviously he wasn't gay. Look at how against sodomy he was. That only works if you accept a limited definition of sodomy.
Euphemistic words are so interesting when it comes to legislation and criminalization of gay stuff. Because it allows you to, in not saying something specifically, it allows for this weird sliding scale. Like when I was in law school, they would say homosexual conduct, but homosexual conduct allows for space all the way from wearing a rainbow pin to rimming someone. And we always feel as though it is like there is an inclination that gays have to feel like it is safer to not say the direct thing, because if you say the direct thing, it will scare people. But then it does allow for this sliding identification of it not being specific. And when you say sodomy, it's like, did he just kiss a boy, or, you know, did he like summon demons in the woods, you know?
Right.
And one could be part of the other. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How could we know? No, that's true. And the other sliding scale that I think is important to bring up here is this, or maybe it's more of a spectrum, but between sodomy on like bad, you know, on one side, and friendship, male friendship, yes, on the other. And I think the fact that there are blurred lines between those two things is actually what allows queer men to live somewhat openly in this period, like queer men like James, for mm-hmm. example, because all of his queer behavior still today can be explained away as romantic friendship or homosocial relationship. So it's interesting that, like, on one hand, you'll see people talking about James and George as sodomites and just being like, yeah, no, they are doing butt stuff in like the poems that they're circulating about them. And then on the other, you have people being like, oh, of course they're kissing each other in public. They love each other and that's great. They're buddies, you know? So I think that's also an interesting spectrum to keep in mind that exists at this time. Okay, the last thing about context, I just said that word homosocial. So this is a very homosocial society in the sense that men spend a lot of time with other men and women spend a lot of other time with women. And I'm not going to get into all of the complexities of that. I definitely don't have to explain to you what it means, but it means that some of the things that we think are automatically sexual, like men sharing a bed together, or that are very possibly sexual, would very often have been seen as completely normal and asexual. So we have to keep that in mind when we're trying to sort of understand the evidence that we're presented with here.
And just to the point of homosociality and Britain specifically, there is this tradition of public schools where you send your son to an all-male school. Like, by this point in time, it's been going on for 200 years. It is not something that happened to royal children at that point in time, but it is definitely something that happens to noble children. And there is just a general expectation that part of, you know, nice hanging out for boys pre-18 is they're going to fuck each other a little bit. Like, that's just, they got to.
Buggery. Yes. Yeah. No, there is that. And like Eton, Cambridge, Oxford, all of these places have been established for hundreds of years by now. Yeah. Everyone, you know, gets educated there. You get sent away. You live with all of these other men.
The other interesting thing. And there are also institutions that are run by the church, which, as we've said, is a place where, you know, man fucking is a little more normal.
Yeah, yeah. Familiar territory, certainly.
Yeah.
The other way that gays meet each other is, this is also a very rural population, right? Like 75% of England is rural. But all of these different houses have lots of servants. So there's a very like growing servant class. And the people that you meet in your village are frequently servants who are coming from other villages who are basically looking for money and food and shelter, right? So there starts to develop this kind of trope around servant boys being kind of like, you know, fair game for a master. And it is, it's like, it's master and servant relationship.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Like.
So, for example, Sir Francis Bacon, who is a friend of the essayist and scientist, I think he did the scientific method or something important like that. He was a friend of King James I and George, his favorite. And he got done eventually for having too much sex with his Welsh servant boys. That like literally became his exclusive type.
I did not know that.
Yes. So that was... I think it was a more politically motivated trial, but he was put on trial for accepting bribes. And part of the evidence brought against him was that he was into these Welsh brunettes.
Fucking a Welsh servant boy is pretty
fucking a Welsh
is pretty close to just fucking a sheep. And I feel like a landlord should be able to do that.
All part of the sodomy game, right? Bestiality, gay, Welsh. So yeah, that was another kind of, so all of this to say that there is no such thing as a gay identity yet, right? We're still, we're operating in that murky spectrum between friendship and sodomy.
Yes.
But there is some kind of subculture starting to develop.
And also like a more complex idea of like a world where consent is very different because people have power over each other, where like hierarchy is real and present. But to the point of urbanization, let us not forget that enclosure has been going on for about 100 years now, where
thank God you brought up enclosure.
Like what happened was like British landlords realized that you could make more money by putting up shrubbery that would keep in sheep, and instead of farming the land for wheat, you would just have sheep. But it meant that there were a shit ton of people who did not have jobs anymore, and so they ended up going to cities or being displaced and working, as you're saying, as servants. And you know, in these servants' halls or in these theatrical troupes or pubs or these urban spaces that they went to, you know, the creative boys found each other.
Yes. Yeah. No. And we'll get back to theater and how it was used as a gay weapon in a moment. Mm-hmm. But that's, see, this is why I need you. You're just pulling that little enclosure history out of your hat. No, so very much so. And the writers, the Puritans, everybody is noticing this, right? That's also how we know about this, because people are making fun of the gays. People are making fun of particularly aristocratic men who are being seen as too effeminate. They're too touchy-touchy with one another. The theater is a little gay. You know, well, they're all sorcerers and into witchcraft as well.
I had never thought about this before, but like in early Protestantism, when you're sort of like, oh no, we have to take down all of the pretty art, and oh no, we should not have the incense, fucking men probably seems like popery. Like, probably, like, so, like, as you have this sort of, like, Puritan swell that hasn't really come to a head yet, but is about to, like, it probably the notion of even a very emphatically Protestant king who loved to touch other men, you are like, that's halfway back to Rome.
Yes. No, very much so. And sodomy qua anal sex was known as the Florentine vice.
Oh,
right?
Really?
At the time. Yeah. So that persisted into the 17th century and started because it was there was so much of it happening in Florence in the Italian Renaissance, right? I mean, there was literally a police force to try to quell it, to try to catch all of the sodomites, called the Office of the Night. So that's very much a thing.
Yeah.
Okay, now we have our solid grounding. We know that there's a little queer culture developing. Let's get into who James was and how he became King of the Queers.
Act 2, James I, Queen of Queens.
Okay, so like we said earlier, James was famously Mary Queen of Scots' son, and she is probably much more famous than James, I would say. So on first glance, you would be like, oh, that's exciting. That's cool that he's her son. But I think it's actually kind of one of the most tragic parts of his life because Mary, well, I mean, I read a biography about Mary when I was 20 years old or something. And I was like, God, this bitch was cool. Like, why didn't I know about her? She's just as cool as Elizabeth. But she was also kind of a selfish bitch. And
Elizabeth
she got
was
into
a winner. Elizabeth, I like queens who don't get beheaded.
Yeah, who don't get trapped and imprisoned. No, but Mary did, like, she was powerful, she was intelligent, but she fucked things up in Scotland. She bet on many of the wrong horses, and it basically left her baby son to fend for himself with all of these extremely ambitious, violent Scottish nobles for much of his youth.
Scottish politics is always super rough. You have these, like, Highlandy murdery people. It's you're basically sort of like running a bunch of gangs, and he
clans, clan life,
clans, and you always got France outside the door. Like, you're like, France is always telling you what to do, because if you don't do what France tells you what to do, like, England's gonna invade. And he's a fucking baby.
Yes. No, and I was reading about it, and they talk about the Scottish nobles more like they were sort of little princes themselves. Like, that's kind of how it worked in Scotland. So yes, there was a king of Scotland, but he was kind of like the first amongst equals, you know? So there definitely isn't, and that's actually probably why James wrote so vehemently about the sanctity of the monarch, right? And was always trying to sort of defend why he needed to be protected at all times, because he got pushed around a lot. So Mary is off, you know, languishing or running away for pretty much after he's 1 year old, I think. He was born on June 19th, 1566. Of course, in Edinburgh Castle, which you can still go see today. Of course, because this is a queer podcast, we will be looking at his astrological birth chart. He was a Cancer, meaning he was, I like to look at these just to see if they actually vibe at all with the character, yes, that I've been uncovering. So CoStar says he was deeply sensitive, nurturing, and gentle. His emotions may have been a bit of a burden to him. He was deeply committed to relationships and being good to the people he cared about, and may have had trouble with self-discipline. Now, I hope to show you, dear listener, that this is pretty spot on for James, particularly the bit about trouble with self-discipline.
The hardest part about monarchy is so many of these people are born to this, and it's not what they are built for. Like, there are so many of them who you're like, this would just be so great if it went in some other direction. And then when you get somebody like a Henry VII, a Henry VIII, an Elizabeth I, an Elizabeth II, who just like, oh God, they're good at the job. They fucking sings, you know? And like a guy like this, you're just like, oh, stop tripping over yourself.
Yeah, and it's always, I think it's always like a suppression of self, you know? And that is, James refused to do that. But I think for quite a good psychological reason. So that's let's talk about his childhood a little bit, because I think it'll reveal what he was after for the rest of his life. So like we said, he's not only deserted by his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, who basically chooses her lover, the Earl of Bothwell, over him and his security. He also doesn't have a father, because his mother was in cahoots with other Scottish nobles to kill his father, who was Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, who we don't feel bad because he was a drunken asshole, but and also potentially bisexual, by the way, interestingly. But she did have him stabbed and then sort of like blown up in a house, I think. If I recall from the Mary biography. So he grew up under the protection of all of these Scottish nobles who were different regents fighting over who got to be in charge, basically. And he was kept at Stirling Castle. he had an incredible education. He was also extremely bright, spoke tons of languages, Latin, Greek. Scots was another language back then. So he spoke Scots. He learned French, English, of course, and very, very well learned in religion. He was a firm and devout Protestant for all of his life. He also had tutors who were very strong disciplinarians. So he's just not having fun ever. And everyone wants a part of him, right? Because they know that not only is he the current king of Scotland, being ruled by a regent, but will one day, you know, take the throne himself. He's also the heir to the English throne because Mary, Queen of Scots, is descended from Henry VII, the first Tudor king. So everybody knows that they need to have a piece of this kid. And it's you know, amidst all of this hand grabbiness and kidnappings and sword fights in first thing in the morning in all of these castles, that his first love, a cousin of his father, arrives at the Scottish court. This guy was named Esme Stuart, who I think I read was the first person to make the name Esme popular, which is kind of badass.
A man named Esme. It's amazing.
and was, spoiler alert, kind of gay himself. Now, actually, let me just read this little excerpt, because we have a contemporary chronicler who described that James conceived an inward affection to the Lord d'Aubigny, that's Esme, and entered into great familiarity and quiet purposes with him. Mm. He was altogether persuaded and led by him, and is in such love with him as in the open sight of the people, often he will clasp him about the neck with his arms and kiss him.
The thing that's so funny to me about the Scottish court at this point in time is that the higher level members of the court are going back and forth to Paris so frequently, and like you have like cowboy court up in Edinburgh, and then you're going to like kind of the most sophisticated and like fuckinest place. And so I do like that it is an emissary, like somebody with a French title, who shows up and he's like, yeah, let's do this.
Yeah, no, and that was a huge deal for James as well, who was, like we said, this very clever, precocious young guy, but was living his cold, rainy, mean, dangerous Scottish life. And then suddenly d'Aubigny, Esme Stuart, shows up and is like, I'm kind of French. What's up? Mm-hmm. And you know, that's like and also he's a family member, mm-hmm. right? So he's his father's cousin. So they get very, very close. James is 13 or 14 at this point. He makes Esme the Earl of Lennox, and he gives him a ton of other titles. He starts to get very rich and bossy. And so a very familiar cycle starts to establish itself, which will be repeated over and over throughout James's reign, where he chooses one guy who he's obsessed with, gives them everything, sort of over favors them, and then all of the aristocrats get pissed and band together to do something about it.
The economics of favoriting is a thing that I am obsessed with, and it's always like difficult to wrap my head around, because on the one hand, from the political angle, you know, these people are cash strapped and they're constantly having to call parliaments so that they can raise more money, and then how do you have enough money that you can truly like blow up someone's life enough that it makes sense for Julianne Moore to like get her son in that situation. And like Henry VIII, of course, pulled off managing to do it with six different wives by stealing everything that the Catholic Church had. But I am always just so and built that amazing palace for the Churchills. I am always sort of like
Blenheim.
Like, yes, how was James affording to be able to like blow up these people's lives?
This is the thing. This is why it's not a bunch of nobles who are like, it's annoying that you're so into him. He is taking from them to give to the favorites, right? Yeah. There is a finite number of titles, peerages, homes, country homes, all of that in the land. Although they do actually invent some peerages sometimes. But that's the problem here. I mean, I actually didn't even think about that really, but like that's the problem here is that favoritism is somewhat necessary in the court, right? Yes. Because it allows you to play ambitious nobles off of one another, which has always been a problem in the history of the British crown, right? But James overdoes it, right? He puts too much in one camp, and and that was what Elizabeth didn't do, and that was why this was also such a shock to the English court.
The thing that they teach you in like Tudor Stuart British history class is like what made her a good monarch is she ran on a clean enough budget that she almost never had to have parliaments. And the minute you call a parliament, they're like, well, yes, we'll pass this tax for you, but also here's what we don't like about you. And, you know, like, it goes far enough, they're beheading you. But, like, you know, if even short of that, they're passing laws that say, well, you have to ask us about this now.
Yeah, I didn't know that, actually. But that's the same reason that Henry VII was seen as, like, a very good monarch, because they're chief financial officers, basically.
I mean, the best thing I learned, you probably learned this in class as well, is that there are still, like, books that we have where line items for accounting are signed off HR Henry Rex, because Henry VII was going through and just making sure that the books balanced.
Because he literally invented HR. Interesting. Wow. Okay. I actually did not know that. That's wild. Okay, wait, but back to Esme.
Yes.
So Esme in 1582 gets too big for his boots, and some of the Scottish nobles band together and kidnap James and force him to throw Esme out of the country. So Esme has to go back to France. He dies the next year. He's only 40 years old, although that's probably a pretty good run back then. You know, James, basically, according to one historian, maybe you've come across Lady Antonia Fraser.
Of course.
Yeah, so she wrote a biography of James in the 70s, which was kind of a big deal because she was sort of more, she was nicer to him, basically, yes, than previous historians had been. And she says that the rest of James's life would be a search, quote, a search to recapture the golden youthful quality of his early passion for Esme.
Oh, that's so sad.
So sad, right? And I mean, but you can see why. I mean, finally, this one guy is like, I love you, kiddo. And then they all make him send him away, and then he dies a year later.
Yeah.
So, I mean, James, I think, was a very lonely and private kid. And so this is another thing that Antonia Fraser says, is that his dominant quality would become an inability to resist love.
Okay.
So I think that's really important to keep in mind when we're talking about his favorites as we go forward.
The question of like how much you let yourself come out, how much you let yourself be honest and in the same room with the emotions that you have is always so interesting for queer people. Mm. And just the idea of like, because for such a long time, I had to be shut off to those things. Now, I can so easily be pulled by this inability to resist love that like is just that's such a resonant way of putting it.
Yeah. No, I know it's almost like we're more susceptible in a way, but also more resistant.
Well,
like,
I think,
but when it
like some people yes, some people no, but like I always want to I spent so long not giving into temptation that I'm now so seduced by giving into temptation. But then I think there are also those people who are fucking bricks of ice. You know, I can think of a certain Prussian king who lost a boyfriend early on and then was just like, I will resist love and that will be the only thing that I do.
Mm, yeah. Well, I think James's issue though is that he really can't. Like yeah. he just wants to be loved so badly, so much so that he will he will sort of reorder his kingly priorities to make that work. And that's why he develops such a bad reputation in history as well. Even though he was actually quite well liked during his reign. Okay, so the other thing to question is what the hell did Homeboy look like? I have seen the portraits from his childhood, and the single word that comes to mind is busted. His eyes are not the same size ever. He looks kind of like a little gnome boy. He was apparently very tall and lanky and just a bit awkward physically. Some people said, some historians think that he might have had some form of cerebral palsy. So he fidgeted a lot and had like twitches. So and at the time that was, you know, obviously people didn't know what that was. So people commented on that a lot. He also, when he got to England, the portraits start to get a little more cute. Mm-hmm. Obviously they had higher paid portraitists there because he starts to look kind of like a handsome daddy when he gets to England. He also spoke English. Like I said, Scots was his first language. So he spoke English with a heavy, heavy, thick accent, and didn't have the best, you know, diction or whatever, it's elocution. So people found him very difficult to understand and made fun of him for that as well. So the overall portrait that you get of James when you read biographies of him is that on the one hand, he's an extremely thoughtful, intelligent, learned, precocious kid, but then he's also this sort of like bumbling, lanky teenager who thinks that everybody's out to kill him. So also a big, you know, contrast, I guess, between internal and external realities for him. The next big kind of moment is when he starts to take control of the Scottish throne. He's technically been king since he was a year old. He was crowned in 1567, but he starts to really flex in 1583, 1584 when he's turning 18. And then his mother is executed in 1587, which he seems to have been maybe potentially complicit in some ways, or at least he didn't actively campaign against it as much as he could have. He later spun that and referred to it as a preposterous and strange procedure. But he was kind of assumed to have not done enough to help his mother, which honestly kind of makes sense because she was trying to get rid of him and get herself proclaimed Queen of Scotland the entire time that he was alive. So they're very kind of like succession battling one mm-hmm. another. And then she's out of the picture. And then James kind of becomes not a terrible king in Scotland. Like he's grown up playing all of these nobles off of one another, well, living in fear of them, but eventually he learns to play them off one another. And Scotland is relatively stable in the late 1580s, 1590s. He is also playing Elizabeth quite cleverly. He secures an annual pension from her. And that's obviously, you know, to help control what's going on in Scotland. But let's
be serious here. Elizabeth let him think that he was successfully playing her. Like, she paid the rabble up north to not be too much a rabble because she had a Spain to deal with and she dealt with it.
You anti-Scottish, pro-British monster. But he's obviously in a weaker position than she is. But he also knows that she can't fuck with him that much because she doesn't have any options besides him in terms of the succession. So a lot of this, and Elizabeth's courtiers start to curry favor with James for that reason.
That's right? What I think is saddest about the Charles cancer diagnosis is he spent 70 goddamn years waiting for everybody to have to treat him like the boss. And then the minute he gets the job, he gets the diagnosis. And now I bet you every fucking one of those courtiers is playing to William as hard as they can.
Yes, that's so true. I didn't even think about that. How's he doing, little guy?
I don't know.
And now Kate has kind of stolen his his cancer.
I know! He doesn't even have that!
It's all part of Camilla's brilliant plan. Okay, so whether you think Elizabeth or James was cleverer, the point is James is actually doing like a pretty okay job in Scotland, all things considered. He also is married to Anne of Denmark. So she's a really interesting character that I don't know enough about, actually, having learned more in just the past 2 days. So she kind of saw herself as intrinsically superior to James in the royal pecking order, like who's this little fucking king of Scotland? And she kind of like didn't fuck with him very much. Like they were sort of estranged, but at the same time, James really respected her opinion and he didn't allow anyone into his personal royal household without her approval. Some kind of like weird mommy dynamic going on there, I think, but like, you know, that's what he really did need a queen and she played that quite well. They also had 3 children and then the first heir dies and then Charles becomes the heir and Charles I eventually. And Elizabeth, his daughter, becomes married to the Elector of the Palatinate or whatever it's called, or one of those. And then her descendants, I think, become the Hanover kings.
Yes. Elizabeth,
if I'm not mistaken.
The Winter Queen, because she was queen of Bohemia for 3 months.
Oh, Bohemia. That's what it was. The Elector of Bohemia.
No. She was the wife of the Elector Palatine. But then he fought to claim the electorate of Bohemia, but then the Habsburgs handed his ass to him.
Okay. All right. So I was right.
Yes.
She plays kind of a sideline role throughout this, because she's the one who approves which favorites get to be a part of the royal household. So we'll get back to that in a minute. But James also, it has to be said, was kind of flaunting his homosexuality in Scotland.
Making copies, move, I'm gay.
Like from the 1580s, the 1590s. The favorites, the most famous favorites that he had were in England, the ones that, you know, we're going to talk more about today. But there were others in Scotland who, again, were like vicious with one another and were also often trying to sell James out to Elizabeth. So one of them was George Gordon, who he made the Marquess of Huntly. Or no, he married him to Esme Stuart's sister so that George could be royal enough to become his captain of the guard and, of course, sleep in the same bed with him. No, but of course, that's all just buddy, buddy, buddy. But he definitely went out of his way to make sure that strapping young George was in his bedroom with him every single night. And then there was Francis Stuart Hepburn, who interestingly was the nephew of the Earl of Bothwell, the guy that married, the second husband that Mary ran away with. Actually, that was her third husband at that point. And Francis, it was known that James routinely kissed and fondled him at court. He was a vicious little prick and eventually tried to sell James out. And there was some downfall there. But it's all just to say, like, this cycle of promoting favorites and fondling them for all to see started very early on in James's career. And he actually was king for a very long time, if you think about it. He was king of Scotland from like the 1580s to 1620. It was a solid like 40 plus year reign there.
Here's my big question about having gay favorites in Scotland. It's so cold and rainy, you can't really wear a bare midriff. You have to wear sleeves.
And, no crop tops.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, how do you really catch attention? I mean, sure, you can layer and wear scarves and stuff, but I feel like that's boyfriendy action. That's not catching a man action.
Well, there's a lot of kilt to play with.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
No underwear underneath the kilt. There's also a lot of, from what I understand from what they're doing in England, the king goes on progress around the country. Mm-hmm. And I think these like hot little twinks are basically like, it's my turn to be in the jousting competition or whatever and show off to the... So I think they have little kind of twink pageants, basically.
Oh, that's wonderful.
For the king as he's moving around the country. At least that's what they did in England. So I imagine that's how they do it in Scotland as well.
And I mean, I'm sure that we're going to get to this with George Villiers, but you just have to wonder how long it takes for ladies to clock that the way up is like pimping out your son to the king. And like, how aggressively do you take it? I mean, it's the wonderful thing, like, when you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. And I'm sure, like,
yes,
if you just secure a good girl from a good family with, like, a decent amount of money for your son, that's the long game. But, like, some people are like, we got to get this while we can get this.
Yes. Well, and I think that we'll talk about it when we get to George. I think that's what made him and his mother different.
Uh-huh.
Was that like for the other favorites, it was like, establish your position, right?
Yeah.
Like get a better peerage, get a richer wife,
yeah,
whatever. But for George, it was more about political power.
Yeah.
And for one of his other favorites to some extent as well, although his wife would be his downfall. But I think that's the game that Mary and George saw, was that it wasn't just about getting the titles or the wife or the money. It was about holding on to political power.
And like, this is such a weird time for politics, because you do have elections and stuff, but royal favor is what matters. Like the person who he picks in like parliament to run things is going to run things, and you know, far more is going on amongst like at the dinner parties of the higher nobility than, you know, in like at the court of St. James.
And privy council and all of that. I mean, there's like, there's an organism around the king that is stamping the papers and making the decisions, like, no matter what parliament says. So yeah, absolutely. And that's why like favorites are not just like sponsored little twinks. Like they are controlling who has access to the king, who speaks to the king, who gains an audience with the king. So yeah, that's a great point. It's all controlled through that like absolute center. So okay, James is like living it up in Scotland, having his gay life, and things are ticking along. And then Elizabeth dies in 1603, 45-year-long reign. God rest our queen's soul. But people are actually pretty excited for James because Elizabeth actually was, you know, even though she's the Virgin Queen and, you know, the English Renaissance, all that stuff we were talking about, like she develops a reputation for sort of stinginess and inertia. Like she's just not like doing very much. And so people, you know, she's an old queen. She's tired. She's done a lot. So James is kind of heralded as this, you know, breath of fresh air initially. It very quickly becomes clear that he is not your average, you know, guy's girl. He is a different kind of king. A popular couplet is circulated as soon as James gets to London, the Latin for which I will absolutely read, Rex fuit Elizabeth, nunc est regina Jacobus, which means Elizabeth was king, and now James is queen.
Wonderful.
So that is like the song that people is that's like the pop hit that people are singing when James arrives in London. That said, he does have like a network set up already because he knows all of these English courtiers. What's his name? The big one for Elizabeth, William Cecil, or I think that's
Lord
him.
Burley.
William Cecil. Lord Burley is still around for part of James's reign, and he was really instrumental in making sure there was a smooth transition. So James has like a lot of stuff going on already in England in terms of his networks of power and patronage.
Let me ask you a question.
Please.
You've been reigning in Scotland for 20 years. You show up to London. You've got the fucking English treasury at your hand. You are a very, very gay king. What's the first thing you buy yourself? You buy yourself when you show up in London?
One of those fancy new enemas. I'm getting fucked tonight. No, I don't know. I mean, I guess he really didn't have very much money, right, in Scotland, so he wouldn't have been used to.
Yeah.
You know what I would do? I would throw a party.
Yeah.
I would throw a party. I don't want things. I want experiences.
I like that.
I'm a millennial king.
Yes.
I'm a millennial king. What are you buying?
Oh, I mean, party is a good option. I was like, I would probably get some new waistcoats. You know, I would probably just get some like...
Sensible.
You know, like new fashions so that I don't embarrass myself.
Something better for the lighter reign.
Yes.
that you'll be living in for the rest of your life. So James comes to London amidst all of this fanfare, and actually James's reign in England was not terrible overall. I mean, at least by my standard, he wasn't a very militaristic king. So I don't think there was any major like war that they were engaged in during James's English reign. And there were also relatively low taxes for like common people. So people actually liked him a lot. And he was very much mourned by the public when he died in 1625. But of course, there was this whole campaign against him and his favorites. And it doesn't start with George Villiers. And we have to go through this story because this guy is such a key character for how George comes into play. But his first great love was actually a boy named Robert Carr, who is a young page boy from Scotland who accompanies James to England, then gets sent back home for whatever reason. And a few years later, shows up in one of these tournaments and very strategically falls off of his horse.
Oh, wonderful.
In front of the king. And so this is their like meet cute. And the king rushes off of the platform where he's sitting and enjoying the festivities, and cradles this kid and tends to him personally, gets him his own royal doctor. Almost the next day, he's appointed gentleman of the bedchamber because he's just so adorable. And this guy has like broken his leg. You know, he put in the work. But from then on, it's a very steady rise for Robert Carr. I believe this was about 1607. So this guy is going to spend the next 6 years, basically, 6 or 7 years, as the ultimate favorite in James's retinue.
Feels so good. The prince constantly leaneth on his arm, pinches his cheek, and smooths his ruffled garments. Carr hath all favors. The king teacheth him Latin every morning. I tell you, this Scottish lad is straight-limbed, well-favored, strong-shouldered, and smooth-faced, with some sort of cunning and show of modesty.
I love how it starts like observational, sort of like, you know, they're always together, and then it's like very suddenly physical. Like that's the explanation of why he's teaching him Latin, wink wink. So everyone in London thought that Carr was kind of like a dumb Scottish guy.
Yeah.
So when it got around that the king was teaching him Latin every morning, somebody quipped, well, he should teach him English first.
Because reading is what?
Fundamental. Oh,
that's very funny. That's very funny. That's a good joke.
So that was pretty solid. Now, James, by this point, is, let's do the math, 40, right? He's starting to reach that age in early modern England when you are becoming old and senile. So developing any number of maladies. So James falls ill with gout, and Carr immediately becomes his nurse. And that's yet another opportunity, actually kind of a la Queen Anne and Duchess of Marlborough. That's another opportunity for him to become even more indispensable to James.
James seems a little dykey to me. James is very like nurturing, and like the fact that this kid showed off,
always falling in love on the first date. Yes.
Well, and also that this kid made him fall in love by injuring himself. I mean, any self-respecting gay guy would be like, no, bring me the strong one. And he's like, oh, the poor baby.
Yes, that is so true. That's true. He does have a father kink, it must be said.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and all of these kids are like kids, you know, they're in their late teens, early 20s when they grab the attention of the king. But he always refers to them as his sons.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I said earlier was hole gaping, but is actually more, it's not son in the hot way. It is son very much in the you are my child way.
Yeah.
Wife, that's a different story. But so Carr gets made Earl of Somerset, which is a big step up for him. And he becomes increasingly wealthy. He is pretty much making all of the decisions in the Privy Council and controlling access to James. And people are, and Carr is a fucking piece of work. Like, people are really starting to hate his attitude. Even James starts to hate his attitude.
Is he smart? Is he good at it?
We don't think so.
Uh-huh.
We don't think so. I think he is, what is this quote I have? He's very decisive and doesn't show his temper in the Privy Council, uh-huh. Right? He doesn't show what he thinks. So I think he's a good courtier to some extent, but he's not necessarily making like the best decisions for the government, or at least not the decisions that the aristocracy thinks are the right ones.
Right.
So Carr and James start to grow apart a little bit. James specifically is mad at Robert Carr for not sleeping in the same room with him anymore. So he has this letter where he writes to him. I leave out of this reckoning your long creeping back and withdrawing yourself from lying in my chamber, notwithstanding my many hundred times earnest soliciting you to the contrary, accounting that but as a point of unkindness. So he's pissed that he will not sleep in the same bed with him anymore. And Robert Carr is also kind of busy falling in love with this other Chiquita that we're going to get to in a second.
How ugly must you feel if you're God's chosen representative on the British Isles? You are king of the entire land and sea around you. And this guy is like, I don't know if we need to sleep in the same room. I would be pissed. That's a good for Robert Carr. Like, once you get that title, like, the trouble with gay favorites is they don't produce enough male heirs. You need somebody, like, that title is always, like, extinct within three generations. And, you know, I like that he is trying to crank out some male heirs.
True. He's got dynasty on his mind.
Yes.
That's fair. He does choose an absolute monster of a woman, who we'll get to in a moment because she's a key part of the story. But I think Robert Carr is the first example, the first proof, evidence to the English aristocracy that James has this bizarre approach to favoritism, and that he frequently, like we said, he's looking for love. He frequently lets his lesbian heart rule his head.
Yeah.
And he'll have many other favorites, but none of them are as handsome, ambitious, and longstanding, actually, as George Villiers, who's up next on part two of this series on King James I and his favorite boy toys. So that concludes part one of our expose on the Queen of Queens. Thank you so much for listening. P.S. Isn't Guy Branum just the best? Like, I feel so lucky to have him on the pod and on this episode in particular. So thank you, Guy, so much. We've got part two coming up next in a couple of weeks. So go watch the new show on Starz, Mary and George. It's out in all its gay glory on Friday, April 5th. And come back to us when you want the real tea. In the meantime, if you love this time period as much as I do, check out our episode on Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare. It's the third episode we ever did on this show. These guys were England's first theater gays who were alive and kicking, well, for the most part, at the same time as King James and all of his boys. As always, if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. It helps us immensely. And you know what? When you're good to mama, mama's good to you. Thanks again for listening. Love you.